evening, neighbors. Have you got a dollar in your pocket? Well, of course you have. Well, take it out and have a look at it, will you? You worked hard for that dollar, didn't you? I just want you to realize that everything we say here tonight has to do with the value of that dollar in terms of the things you want to buy and your prospects for getting more or less of these dollars. In short, this discussion concerns you very much indeed. Our topic is, should industry grant labor's demands for a 30% wage increase? Walter Reuther says yes. George Romney says no. Mr. Reuther, Vice President of the United Automobile Workers Union, CIO, is spearheading this movement in his union and has stated the demands of his union in an open letter to Mr. Charles E. Wilson, President of General Motors, in which he states, quote, our demand is made with the knowledge that it will not necessitate any price increases. And this, of course, is our main interest as members of the public. Last week, Mr. Wilson replied to Mr. Reuther on this point, quote, your demands are definitely inflationary, and your union is responsible for trying to start an inflationary spiral of increasing wages, costs, and prices, unquote. Mr. Reuther and his associates maintain that industry in general, and the automobile industry in particular, can make the wage increase out of profits without raising the prices of cars. He arrives at the figure 30%, as this represents the drop in the take-home pay anticipated by the reduction of wartime 48-hour week to the normal 40-hour week. Mr. Wilson disputes this claim on the basis of his analysis of the facts and concludes his letter to Mr. Reuther with the statement, we reject your unreasonable demands. There's one point, however, on which both Mr. Wilson and Mr. Reuther agree. That is that this is more than an ordinary collective bargaining quarrel. It's a national problem. We're therefore fortunate in having with us this evening representatives of both sides of this important controversy who are competent to discuss the question specifically and in national terms. Mr. Reuther, as vice president of his union, assigned especially to General Motors, has been in the forefront in negotiations which have attracted national attention for several years. Mr. George Romney is general manager of the Automobile Manufacturers Association and is therefore in a position to present the views of industry on this question. Now we hear the side of the affirmative presented by Walter Reuther. Mr. Reuther.
The basic issue before us tonight is one which transcends the interests of labor management. It affects the welfare of Americans in every walk of life. A realistic and equitable solution to the problem of wages, prices, and profits is an economic must if we are to win the peace. To debate this issue in America's town meeting of the air is in the best American tradition. In the same tradition, our union has proposed to the General Motors Corporation that our wage demand for a 30% increase be discussed in public negotiations. Unfortunately, the corporation has refused such public negotiations. General Motors has stated that the question of wages, prices, and profits is not the public's business. We believe that it is. We shall continue to urge the corporation to agree to public negotiations. When both parties put all their cards on the table, the public can then judge who is acting in the public interest. Our 30% demand is not a wage demand in the ordinary sense. We are fighting to restore the purchasing power of workers whose take-home pay has already been cut 30% or more. The challenge this country faces in peace is how are we to put purchasing power into the hands of the people so they can consume in abundance the things we know how to produce. Our fight for greater purchasing power requires that prices must not be increased. To get increased wages out of higher prices is robbing Peter to pay Paul. We have told General Motors that the facts prove that they can pay us 30% higher wages without increasing prices 1 cent. It is on the basis of these facts that we make our demand. Production is not our problem. Our problem in this country is consumption. In 1929, we got into trouble because we had a 12-cylinder Cadillac production economy with a Model T distribution system. In cities, millions of workers went hungry. while farmers lost their farms. We didn't have overproduction. People simply didn't have the money to buy the things they needed. The old Model T distribution system just couldn't keep up with the Cadillac production machine. Now we have a B-29 production machine, backed up by all the potential power of atomic research. If we got into trouble in 29 because the old Model T wouldn't keep up with the Cadillac, it is just ABC economics to know that we are heading for more serious trouble unless we develop a B-29 distribution system to keep up with our B-29 production machine. Judge Benson, now Secretary of the Treasury, recently said, quote, "The American people are in the pleasant predicament of having to learn to live 50% better than they ever lived before," end quote. That is pleasant, all right, but it is no predicament. All we have to do is to use common sense and get our distribution know-how in balance with our production know-how. During the war, Uncle Sam, the $90 billion customer, kept the wheels of industry going. His place must now be filled by putting purchasing power into the pockets of farmers, workers, white-collared, and professional groups. If private industry is to survive in America, it must provide that purchasing power through higher wages. In 1918, we won the war on the battlefield abroad, but we lost the peace on the economic front at home. It can happen again unless we demonstrate the courage and the unity of purpose in peace as in war. The challenge of peace demands that we have an economy of full employment, full production, and full consumption. Our fighting men must not again come home to sell apples on our street corners. The question of higher wages is a question of fact. Name-calling will not solve our problem. It cannot be settled by full-page propaganda ads by General Motors and other corporations. It must be settled on the basis of sound economic facts. Here are a few of those facts. The total profits of U.S. corporations in 1944 were $25 billion, or 5.5 times their average pre-war profits. The tremendous profits made during the war prove that wages can be raised without increasing prices when maximum production is maintained. In 1940, we had high profits in industry. 43 was even better. If we had taken only the increase in profits from 1940 to 1943 and had given it to the workers in the form of a wage increase, every U.S. industrial worker could have had a 30% wage increase without increasing prices. Think of it. 30% wage increase, no increase in prices, and a high-time 1940 profit for American industry. Mr. Romney knows that in 1941, the last year of automotive production, General Motors made a profit of $510 million before taxes. He also knows that between 1935 and 1941, General Motors earned, after taxes, mind you, a total return of 124% on the stockholders' investment. I am certain that millions of farmers and small businessmen would be pleased to realize a return of 124% on their investment in a period of 7 years. Conservative business journals are already predicting the highest profits in history for 1946. The key to these higher profits is greater volume. Here is an example of what increased production did for General Motors between 1935 and 1941. Wages went up 37%, prices up only 16%, but profits jumped 84%. Why? This was because production increased 21%. Greater volume is the answer to our problem of raising wages without increasing prices. A 21% increase in production enabled General Motors to increase wages more than twice as much as prices and still make 84% greater profits. In 1941, GM produced 2.5 million cars. And yet for every dollar they paid out in wages, they made more than a dollar in profits. 1941 profits were high enough to have given every GM worker a 30% wage increase without increasing the cost of a car one penny, and still the corporation would have made $235 million in profit. All this, mind you, because of 21% increase in volume. Now here is the payoff. General Motors has stated publicly that they expect their volume of production to increase 50% over 1941. The tremendous economies and reduced unit cost of production, which will flow from this 50% increase in volume, will enable GM to grant our 30% increase, maintain 42 prices, and still make a substantial profit. We know that this larger purchasing power we are talking about must represent a larger volume of goods and services. We aren't kidding ourselves. We want wages that buy things. We want to buy the things all the rest of you make, and we want you to buy the cars we make. Another important factor enabling industry to raise wages without increasing prices is the tremendous increase in labor productivity because of improved technology. Here are two examples taken from GM's own report. Quote, at Buick, a newly designed electric welding machine makes it possible to speed up welding of crankshaft balancers from 3 to 36 per hour. Another example, new multiple drill performs 14 lapping operations previously done by a single machine. These examples multiplied 1,000-fold give you an idea of the march of the machine. Time will not permit to go into all the details on the ability of the auto industry to give us a 30% increase without raising prices, but you are entitled to all the facts because it affects your welfare. That is why we say that General Motors should agree to public negotiations. We want the press and the radio there so they can get the facts and pass them on to you. It is understandable that the public is alarmed at growing reports of labor unrest. But the answer to labor-management relations cannot be found in screaming headlines and hysterical editorials. This problem must be solved by removing the basic causes of unrest. American labor won the battle for production in war. It wants to do the same in peace. Management must learn that human engineering is just as important as production engineering. Working conferences of labor management should be called immediately in every basic industry to discuss a realistic wage program, including industry-wide wage agreements based upon equal pay for equal work and a guaranteed annual wage. These conferences would need to develop a new concept of wages, suited to the age in which we live. Wages that are fixed arbitrarily, either by management or by labor, will not work. Wages must flow from our true productive potential and must reflect our ever-increasing ability to create wealth. In August of 1940, we proposed the conversion of the auto industry to war production. These gentlemen who now say we can't raise wages without increasing prices said then that we could not convert the auto industry to war production. We did convert the auto industry to war production because we had a war to win. We can raise wages without increasing prices because we've got a peace to win.
Thank you, Walter Ruther. Now, for the viewpoint of industry, we hear from the extremely able general manager of the Automobile Manufacturers Association, Mr. George Romney. Mr. Romney.
I thought our subject tonight was, should industry grant labor's 30% wage demands? But apparently that just means General Motors. I'm here because this demand should be settled on the basis of public interest. Detroit won the baseball World Series. However, the gravest and most momentous World Series of all time, which started for America on December 7, 1941, is not over. Whether we will win or lose has not been determined. We lost the one that ended in 1918, because after winning the first two contests, we failed to win the last two. And to win the World Series of which I am speaking, a team must win four straight. First, the race of conversion and war production. Second, the battle of military supremacy. For the second time, we have won these two struggles. We must still win the third of reconversion and transition to a peacetime economy. And the fourth and decisive battle of higher living standards for all peoples and permanent world peace. Fantastic as it would be in a baseball series, it is nevertheless true in our infinitely graver World Series that key players on our team have made demands in the form of an ultimatum that they say must be met or they will stop play at the end of the fifth inning of the third contest. Their demands are an immediate 30% wage increase or else. This is being demanded for all players on all teams in the Industrial League, independently of their merits or of the gate receipts. Listen to these cost of living, wage, profit, and productivity facts. First, is the demand of Walter Reuther's union justified by increased living costs? A majority of a special committee appointed by President Roosevelt reported in February of this year that living costs during the war had increased about 30%. This cost of living study was made because unions insisted that a 45% increase had occurred. Do you think a committee appointed by President Roosevelt would have differed with labor unless compelled to do so by the facts? The public members of the National War Labor Board say that during the war, average straight-time hourly wage rates, which they considered most comparable to the cost of living, increased 36.7%. In addition, due to longer hours, take-home pay at these rates increased about 51%. Where overtime has been completely eliminated, wage rates are still close to the average straight-time hourly wage rate, which increased 36%. This means the demand for a 30% increase due to the elimination of overtime is a demand that wages be increased greatly in excess of the 30% increase in the cost of living. Now, is this demand of Walter Reuther's union justified by increased productivity? Listen, because there was no car production, the usual technological advance, which normally increases productivity 2 to 3% a year, was stopped. The job of our industry was to apply its previously developed mass production methods to the output of guns, tanks, and planes, and both methods cited by Mr. Reuther were pre-war methods applied to war production. Each year until the 30s, automobile companies produced cars more efficiently and more cheaply. Prices were reduced and wages increased. In other words, productivity increased. However, since the middle 30s, the rate of increase in productivity has declined and prices have increased. This alarming situation developed before the war. It resulted primarily from short-sighted auto union policies, which, according to the Senate testimony of its own president in 1940, had decreased the industry's productivity between 5 and 10%. Last spring, 5 years later, union, government, and industry witnesses told the Senate Meade Committee that automotive production efficiency on war work was from 15 to 50% below the production efficiency that prevailed in peacetime. In other words, productivity in the automotive industry declined during the war. It did not increase above peacetime levels. What are the prospects for the future? A few vehicle and parts companies have resumed their peacetime production. What has their experience been in terms of productivity? An automobile company sustained a 4-day strike when it refused paint spraymen 20 minutes relief time an hour instead of 15 minutes because they were doing less than 2/3 as much work as before the war. In a parts plant where 385 pieces were made each day before the war, the company had a strike over union demands to reduce production below 350 pieces per day. A foundry in Cleveland is using 25% more men than before the war to get pre-war production. A tool company's new methods and equipment were supposed to raise productivity almost 50%. But notwithstanding these improvements, efficiency is 15% lower than before. A truck company out west states its productivity is 25% below pre-war levels. The story's the same whether you talk to production men in Detroit, Chicago, Milwaukee, Cleveland, or eastern cities. Company size makes no difference. Employers with 100,000 workers and those with only 24 men give the same answers. Under these circumstances, how can a 30% wage increase be granted in anticipation of greater productivity? It is Walter Reuther's position that the 30% wage demand can be met without charging the public more for automobiles. Listen to these facts, all broken down to a man-hour basis so that everyone can understand them. The average basic hourly wage rate in the automobile industry is about $1.15 an hour. The 30% increase would be 35 cents an hour. In the biggest wartime production year, 1944, car companies paid taxes of 25 cents for each man-hour worked and about 9 cents to stockholders, making a total of 34 cents. But these funds have been spent. All other wartime earnings were earmarked for reconversion and expansion. If the total amount of these funds for 1942, 43, and 44 were still available, which of course they are not, they would only amount to 25 cents per hour for a 12-month period. At the present time, every automobile company is losing money and is willing to continue to do so until production has reached volume proportions. The 35 cent wage increase in our industry simply cannot be paid out of current profits. There aren't any. Perhaps Mr. Reuther wishes to divert into wages money to be used to maintain and add to the tools of production. If so, he is betraying his own members. A farmer can feed his hogs his seed corn, and the goose that lays the golden egg can be eaten, but then there'll be no more corn and no more golden eggs. This wage demand attacks the public interest. Farmers, professional workers, white-collar workers, and foreign buyers constitute 70% of the industry's customers. If this wage demand were granted, every American, as a customer, would have to pay it through higher prices. Former war workers cannot secure wage increases at the expense of other customers without disastrous results. This wage demand is inflationary. Americans have a potential inflationary spending power of $160 billion. After World War I, it was an inflationary boom, followed by a deflationary depression that lost that World Series. Under present conditions, improper wage policies could touch off an inflation that would make the last one look like child's play. Automobile companies have always paid increasingly higher wages to match the increasing productivity of workers and will continue to do so as productivity increases. But wages must be based on productivity. If 52 hours pay for 40 hours work would increase car sales, automobile companies would do it. If that's prosperity, why not 52 hours pay for 10 hours work? Then we could all get rich. But obviously, we would all starve. It is equally obvious that only by constantly producing more can we get more. Economics is like a beautiful song or a good story. If the singer is a little off key or the storyteller gets the order of things mixed up, it spoils everything. Walter Reuther is famous for hatching plans. As usual, his latest, How to Raise Wages Without Raising Prices, just gets things a little mixed up. The automotive story is how to raise wages and reduce prices. The key argument in his plan is that to get production, we must first increase purchasing power. Now, I can understand the dilemma about the hen or the egg, whether the hen or the egg came first, but I can't understand any doubt about whether production or purchasing power comes first. Every American knows that our pioneers in any part of the country first had to produce before they could exchange or buy. It is production that makes purchasing power, not the other way around. Yes, and in the western desert areas where my people made the desert blossom as the rose, it was work, hard but satisfying, that wrought the transformation. This principle has not changed. Americans must decide whether they want more idle time and job loafing, or are willing to work more efficiently and longer hours to achieve a rapidly increasing standard of living. If some are paid excess work, excess wages for work not performed, others are going to do without goods and services. The irony of this situation is that unions are deliberately sabotaging their own future. The American customer cannot be kicked around. Most people don't have to buy new cars, and at excessive prices, they won't. That would mean that Mr. Ruther's men would be out of a job. Whether they like it or not, labor and management are on the same team, and to win, they must please the all-American customer. As Walter Ruther said, according to the newspapers, his union does have the power to destroy industry, but in doing so, it would also destroy itself.
We are sorry that time does not permit us to bring you this program in its entirety. The subject discussed was, should industry grant labor's demand for a 30% wage increase, and was originally heard at home on America's Town Meeting of the Air. Mr. Walter Ruther of the United Automobile Workers and Mr. George Romney of the Automobile Manufacturers Association were the speakers who took part in this discussion. The opinions expressed during this broadcast are the opinions of the speakers, and it is not to be inferred that the War Department endorses any of the views expressed. This broadcast was another in the series of discussion programs to be brought to you American servicemen and women overseas, so that you may know what is being said at home on important national and international issues.